Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is July 6th, 2014, and this is episode 58, Future Retro. Welcome again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
Now, this week we're going to be taking a look at the recent-ish trend of throwback games, and taking a look sort of at the varying degrees to which this aesthetic has been used. So buckle in and get ready for that, but first let's start with our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Slaggy McWaggy, if you'd like to kick us off.
Yes, we seem to have been talking about the Mana series lately, and now we've got word through an interview with Dengeki that producer of Rise of Mana, who is Masaru Oyamada-san, says that he would like to release the next major Mana game within the next 2 years.
And, you know, even more interesting on top of that is that in this same interview, he sort of talks about how in the lead-up over the next 2 years, he'd really like to make the previous games in the Mana series available to sort of current, you know, gen players.
Yeah, including Seiken Densetsu Final Fantasy Gaiden.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the first one. That's actually been remade.
Oh, has it?
As recently as, I mean, you know, I think there was a mobile remake, but probably the best known remake was the Game Boy Advance remake as Sword of Mana.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
So, yeah. Let's see. We also here have word that we have a new Saga game coming down the pipeline in the future. You know, that certainly isn't a whole lot to say, but, you know, also from Dengeki, there's this interview with series creator Akitoshi Kawazu, and he basically says, you know, that they are working on a new game. They don't have a whole lot to say at the moment. You know, we'll have to wait a little longer for details, but they are working on a game. It's just down the pipeline a ways yet.
He says, it's advancing steadily, so please don't worry. That's kind of the new please look forward to it.
Indeed. We also have here news about how Senran Kagura Bon Appetit is going to be sold when it is localized for North American audiences. So Senran Kagura Bon Appetit in Japan was actually released as two separate games. It was Senran Kagura Bon Appetit Pack A and Senran Kagura Bon Appetit Pack B. The first game, Pack A, had Hanzo and all of the Crimson Squad characters, and then Pack B had Gessen and Hebijo Ninja Squad from the Shinobi Versus spin-off game. In the U.S., however, or I should say in North America and English-speaking territories handled by XSEED, we're going to be seeing Pack A released as the core game, and then Pack B will just be done as DLC for Pack A.
I'm surprised they didn't call it, like, the A cup and the B cup. You know, because it's cooking and you cook with measuring cups?
Girl. I mean, you're technically right about Senran Kagura, and, you know, something else that I didn't really want to talk about too much on the show here, but XSEED had said this week that they kind of plan Senran Kagura as a series to sort of be the extent of where they are on fan service games. They don't really want to become known as like a cheesecake publisher doing all of these girly games. So Senran Kagura for them is where that's at. And they're going to try to sort of get back on track to doing, you know, the kind of games that they became known for in North America.
Well, that's good to know. We've heard from Kadokawa Games that their tactical RPG Natural Doctrine is coming to North America on September 16th and Europe 3 days later on September 19th. This is, of course, a PS4, PS3, and Vita game. You can pre-order it right now on the Nipponichi America store. And there's, like, limited editions. You can get the regular edition for $60, $50, or $40 on PS4, PS3, Vita. The limited editions are $20 more on each platform. You'll get an art book, poster, and an explorer's bag.
That's actually pretty exciting. You know, I'm really excited for this game. I'm always here for tactics games. So, I don't know. I'm a little bummed that they're not doing, you know, some kind of buy it all, you know, buy, like, the PS4 version, get the Vita version for cheaper.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, whatever. I'll definitely buy at least one copy.
Because that's $100 or so, you know, if you want to get both.
Yeah. Oh, well, though, it's whatever.
I mean, you can cross-play and cross-save, so, you know, maybe it's worth it.
Well, that's why I would have liked to have seen a bundle, because then I definitely would have taken advantage of that. In any event, we also have word here that we have a new character in Guilty Gear Xrd Sign. This, of course, is pretty interesting, because this character is Sin Kisuke, which is the son of Kai Kisuke and Dizzy from the original Guilty Gear series. You might remember this character for his role in Guilty Gear 2, which, you know, obviously this sort of stands that Guilty Gear 2, despite being this weird real-time action strategy spin-off, is definitely a canonical part of the Guilty Gear franchise's story. You know, not that many people in North America necessarily care about the Guilty Gear storyline, but the Guilty Gear fan base is huge about the storyline to that series, so it's really interesting to sort of see Arc System Works doubling down on the storyline of this sort of outcast game that most people don't have very high respect for.
Can you tell us a little bit about his fighting style? Because I thought that was entertaining.
Well, you know, we don't know a ton about it, but he does have a giant flag that he hits people with, and he has like this whole system where you're gonna have to eat to keep his energy up, and he'll be able to throw out repeated special attacks as long as he's not hungry, and then once he's hungry he doesn't have access to his special
ability.
He's
like, oh, I'm in the color guard, but I better go to the snacks shack in between halftime, or else I'm gonna get too hungry to be throwing my flag out on the field.
So that just happened. Alright, we have here the official announcement for Mistwalker's new RPG. This is going to be Terra Battle, as we had discussed last week. You know, this was sort of expected to some degree. And what, you know, unfortunately, as we also expected, this is a new game for smartphones. However, like many of Sakaguchi-san and company's previous projects, it is a role-playing game. It is going to have music by Nobuo Uematsu. So, you know, it looks like it's gonna be like a full JRPG. It is gonna be free-to-play. They're working very specifically on making sure that the microtransactions are optional and not, you know, pay-to-win. And in a fairly encouraging move for sort of the idea that the game might still be well-designed, Sakaguchi has said that he's developing it to be ported down the line to consoles.
Oh, that's a good sign. You know, I've been thinking, like, a lot of these things that aren't the mobile social games may be worth dusting off the Ouya for.
Oh, maybe. Let's see here. We also have news that Sega of Japan is working on the next Ryuga Gotoku game. This is actually going to be releasing on PlayStation 3 and PlayStation 4.
Oh, huh.
So another cross-gen title. You know, a lot of people are surprised they expected the next Yakuza game just to be a PS4 game.
Indeed.
Slaggy McWaggy, I know you want to take this next one.
Oh, I want to take this next one because we're talking about BioWare's first gay male party member. I hope he has a fabulous mare, though, that he rides into battle. This is Dorian the Mage. And, you know, you might have heard a little bit of controversy because David Gaynor referred to this character in interviews as the first fully gay character, and a lot of people kind of took issue with that, but, you know, what he meant is that
this fool's a Kinsey Six.
Yeah, and also this is notable because it is the first time, you know, I'm hesitant to say Commander Shepard would be considered a fully gay character because you were Shepard, you know, every Shepard's different, so not every Shepard would be fully gay. So this is really exciting, you know, I'm really looking forward to Dragon Age Inquisition.
Well,
and
I think
especially with this introduction of this character.
From a game design perspective, I think the use of the term fully gay probably also simply means to state that he's only romanceable by same-sex characters. You know, he's not romanceable by women. And he is apparently going to have a story built around being a mage in the highly ordered mage society that is, like, super anal about, you know, everything sort of fitting the norm and not sort of, you know, breaking the mold. And so we have a character here who is fully gay, having to deal with being gay in that environment. And this is apparently going to be a story beat for this character.
Totally romancing him.
Oh, me too, man, for sure. And this, to me, sort of really breaks ground in terms of what a lot of people over the last few years have been talking about in terms of what we want to see in a gay narrative in a game, is to see a side character sort of have a coming out story and sort of experience that. And so it's really weird to me that people are really attacking them for the use of this term fully gay when, again, from a design standpoint, and okay, maybe it wasn't super PC of them to have used that term, but it really does have a real application showing that this is actually like a really cool stand for them to be taking and a cool character for them to have made.
I just wish that I had time to whip up a Dorian cosplay for Gamer X2 and then be like, oh, hey, David Yater, I'm dressed as your fully gay character. What's up?
Hey. Oh, you mean Gamer X2 next week?
Yes.
And where are we going to be again?
We're going to be at Podcast Cross Zone 2 at Gamer X2 in San Francisco. If you're local, there's still some tickets available. Very few remain. You can come see Captain Spike and a lot of the members of the Hunty Bunch talking and talking about what we do as podcasters. And I'll be there to support y'all and to say hello. So, hello! That's on Saturday, so if you're in San Francisco this Saturday, say hey, hey, hey.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey, hey, hey. Next stop on track here, we have word that Super Time Force is getting a PC port. This is going to be called Super Time Force Ultra, which you may have noticed is spelled out as STFU.
Ah!
Coming to PC players on Steam this summer. They're apparently going to be adding some features, but they're not ready to talk yet about what makes this version Ultra.
Ooh, well, I hope that's also available for the Microsoft consoles. You can also pick up the 53-track chiptune soundtrack as well. So if you played Super Time Force and love the soundtrack, you can pick it up on Bandcamp or iTunes.
We have here North American release dates for Tales of Hearts R. It's going to be launching in North America on November 11th, and Sword Art Online Hollow Fragment is going to release on August 19th.
Yes!
I knew you'd be excited about that.
So not only will Auron, our favorite stud, one of our favorite studs anyway, from Final Fantasy X, be unlockable in Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy Curtain Call, but there will also be a second version available as downloadable content.
Heyo.
He looks a little bit cuter, IDK.
Well, he's not wearing the glasses, and his coat looks different, IDK.
Yeah.
In any event, in addition to this new downloadable character, there is another pack of four songs. We have here Today Arrives, Becoming Tomorrow from Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles, Leviathan Battle from Final Fantasy Fables Chocobo's Dungeon, the Imperial Army theme from Final Fantasy II, and the one that I'm most excited about, Locke's theme from Final Fantasy VI.
Yes!
So that's very exciting. That's definitely one that I'll be picking up Locke's theme, if nothing else, when this game hits here later this year.
Those who are ready to blast off beyond Earth in Civilization Beyond Earth.
Civilization.
Will be able to do so on October 24th. Firaxis has announced that the much-anticipated Civilization spinoff will be coming at that date, and that if you pre-order the game, you'll get the Exoplanets map pack at launch. That's going to have six maps inspired by real exoplanets, like the Earth-like Kepler-186f.
Exciting!
I can't wait. I'm going to pre-order totally, like, right now, basically.
In other release buoy news...
We
also have a release date for Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm Revolution. That's going to be hitting North American shores on September 16th, courtesy of Bandai Namco.
Believe it!
We also have word here that Blaze Blue Battle Cards, this is a mobile social game, card game for mobile iOS, is going to be released in North America this fall. It was announced at the Axis Games Anime Expo panel.
Oh, very cool. You know, why haven't we done a Game Buoy mobile social card game for mobile devices?
Because I don't know how to make that. In very exciting news, we have word here that the Japanese 2D arcade fighting game Dengeki Bunko Fighting Climax, which we've talked about here quite a few times on the show, you know, this is a Dengeki Publications family crossover fighting game. Lots of characters from anime that you're probably familiar with, light novels, manga, including Kirito from Sword Art, and Boogie Pop from Boogie Pop Phantom, with cameos by a couple of Sega characters, including Akira from Virtua Fighter.
I thought you were going to say Akira from Akira.
Oh, gosh, no. The home port, it has been announced, It'll be releasing this fall in Japan for PlayStation 3 and Vita, Dengeki Online has announced, which, of course, because it's a Dengeki game.
Awesome. In some unexpected but very happy news, there's going to be a Mighty No. 9 CG animated series produced by Digital Frontier. It's going to be planned for release in 2016, described as an action-packed comedy aimed at kids aged 6 through 11. In other Mighty No. 9 news, there has been a second crowdfunding campaign launch. This is going to be, according to Concept, for bonus content to be added to the game. The new campaign is going to be used for new game content and help expand Mighty No. 9 to other forms of media, which are going to be reflected in the game itself. Concept has clarified that this does not include the Mighty No. 9 animated series. That funding is secured by Digital Frontier.
Okay, but the way that this reads to me, and I certainly, you know, that's certainly what they've said, and I believe it, I agree with it, the first quote-unquote stretch goal of this new campaign is going to be full voice acting in Mighty No. 9. Originally, there was not going to be any voice acting at all, and now they're talking about doing voice acting. It has been specified that this will be voice acting in English, and they hope to use the cast of the Mighty No. 9 animated series.
Cool.
So the idea here, I think, is that prior to getting the deal for the TV show, they didn't really plan on having much of a narrative in this game. But now that there's going to be a TV show, they want to have a narrative sort of like link up to the show and the game. They want to have the same voice acting consistent between the two.
And hey, there's a new little DLC pack that has to do with this story arc in the show.
That, exactly. That's how I see it. When he talks about how the idea is to expand it through the game to other forms of media, I assume he means additional stuff to link it, to make it, you know, like a full franchise, not just like this in one-off indie game, but, you know, like have anime shows with storylines that tie into the game. So I, again, you know, I have very complex feelings here. But the fact remains that Mighty No. 9 was a huge success on Kickstarter, and prior to adding this stuff, one of the few Kickstarters I can think of where they really did seem to have the right amount of money they needed to sort of, you know, release the product they promised. So, you know, if they're going to add features, every feature you add takes money, and adding voice acting for 15 characters from, you know, TV voice actors with proper recording setups and what have you, $100,000 for that stretch goal to do that actually does seem reasonable to me. So I have mixed feelings in that I wanted the game to be done funding. I wanted it to just be done as it was done. But I'm not, like, mad. I've seen a lot of people online talk about how they feel like Inafune-san is, like, a thief or a cheater or greedy. And I just don't see any of that. I just wish this were less complex. But I don't begrudge them for this. If I hadn't backed Mighty No. 9 previously, I'd be backing it now. And this is, if nothing else, a cool opportunity for people who missed out on backing it the first time that want to jump in now.
Yeah, and you know, best of luck to Concept and Inafune-san. Hopefully that Mighty No. 9 will be able to do what Mega Man is not doing anymore.
All right, well, with all that having been said, it's time for
news. 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 Oh my god, news.
Oh my god, news.
OMG news.
Alright, first up here we have a rather surprising change in direction from the Ouya folks. Now this, you know, it might have been a limited time deal, it might not have been a permanent change, but to me, I feel like this initiative that we're about to talk about marks a change in direction for Ouya. So, in case you missed it last week, Ouya put up a sign-up sheet on their website for what is called the Ouya All Access Pass. And the idea here is that you would pay $60 for a one-year All Access Pass on Ouya's store, and you would then have complete access to all applications and games in the Ouya store for that flat fee that you paid. So, oh, I paid $60, and now for the entire rest of the year, I can play Final Fantasy III, or Broken Age, or Bomb Squad, or Tower Fall, or any other number of awesome Ouya games, all for that same $60 fee I'd already paid.
Yeah, I'm kind of mad that I missed out on this, because, well, you know, I wasn't paying attention to Ouya.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sort of turns Ouya games into a service that you're paying for rather than, you know, individual products. And I have to say, you know, for the $99 hardware that the Ouya is, I actually feel like this is a great marketing plan for them. I feel like this direction for them would probably be, you know, fairly profitable. And I almost even think it would be enticing to a lot of people who don't currently have an Ouya. Just because, you know, to access all of that content for $60, like, there's a lot there. I definitely think is worth $60.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, if you buy these on Steam or on PlayStation Network, etc., Xbox Store, Xbox Live, whatever, you know, if you're only really looking for these sorts of things, this might be a good investment. So we're going to link you over on GameBuoy. There is a sign up for I Want In. Let me know when this will be available again. So that's kind of a hint.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I looked at this sign up page a few days ago, it was still active and now it's down. You know, it's marked as sold out on Ouya's website.
Did you happen to get in?
I didn't, no. And I wish I had. But, you know, I see this link. It's like, you know, I want in to join a mailing list to be notified when it's up again. It seems clear to me that this was probably sort of a time-limited deal for the sake of sort of evaluating the market and seeing if there was an interest in this.
Yeah.
So I have to say it looks to me like it was probably pretty successful, and I expect we will be seeing more of this down the line.
Indeed. Final Fantasy fans will probably be excited about Final Fantasy Artnix Dive, which is a free-to-play RPG for iOS and Android devices released via the GREE platform this summer. Back to the GREE of days past, GREEBUOY. And it is going to play like a classic 2D Final Fantasy games with large maps, complete dungeons, and lots of enemies. You'll be able to summon over 100 different monsters in the game that'll have original characters that will be able to be outfitted with weapons created using collected crafting material. If you're in Japan, you can pre-register for this already. If you refer a friend to the game, you'll be able to get bonus items. So, you know, unfortunately, no word yet on a localization, but we seem to get a lot of these localized, so fingers crossed. It looks pretty, I mean, like in the screenshot they all look like identical characters, but I mean, it still looks good. It looks like a very classic Final Fantasy from what I can see in the screenshot.
In really, really interesting news, we have word that over in Europe, Nintendo has sold their first cross-buy game on the eShop. You know, the lack of cross-buy features on Nintendo platforms is sort of a hot-button issue right now in the console wars. But this game, Squid's Odyssey, which is not by Nintendo themselves,
and does not have anything to do with Splatoon, despite having squids in the title.
Girl, ain't every game with squids got to be about Splatoon.
Splatoon.
But if you bought the game, which came out last week on the Nintendo 3DS, you will be able to download the Wii U version of the game for free, provided that the two devices are both linked to the same Nintendo Network ID.
That's great news. I really hope that this keeps up.
Yeah, yeah, quite a few people do. And, you know, the follow-up to that is that we have word from Nintendo of America that they were not able to run this promotion in North America. They did not state why this was done, or I should say why this was not done, but the people who made Squid's Odyssey, the game bakers, did confirm to Silicon Era that it was Nintendo of Europe that approached them as sort of, you know, doing this promotion with them. It was Nintendo's idea, not the game bakers' idea.
Interesting. And just to clarify, it is only 3DS to Wii U. You cannot buy it on Wii U and get a free 3DS download.
Yeah, this is clearly an infrastructural issue, but, you know, they're obviously working on it to some degree.
Wayward Manor, which comes from Los Angeles-based indie studio The Odd Gentleman, will be coming out for Steam and also from the Humble Store on July 15th. You may be familiar with this game because the story was written by much-beloved author Neil Gaiman.
Indeed. We also have word here that Mad Catz is going to be releasing new arcade sticks for the PlayStation 3 based on Persona 4 Arena Ultimax.
It looks great.
Well, and, you know, even cooler than how awesome it looks is that while it is being sold primarily as a PlayStation 3 controller, it will have PlayStation 4 support once there are for use once there are fighting games on that platform.
And apparently it will let you customize the faceplate and buttons, so I assume that means that other fighting games will be Like, they'll, that Mad Catz will partner with other fighting game developers.
Well, all of the Mad Catz sticks that they've been selling for the last few years have been customizable. What they really mean is that you can swap out buttons if you want to use, like, professional arcade buttons.
Oh, wow.
Rather than the little cheapo guys that they come with. So, yeah, no, these sticks are generally pretty cool. You know, they've been doing them for all of the big fighting games, all of the Street Fighter 4 iterations. I think they did one for Mortal Kombat. So, yeah, it's cool controllers. And, you know, it's really cool to see about this support for PlayStation 4, because while there aren't a lot of fighters on PlayStation 4 yet, we certainly are looking at, you know, Guilty Gear, Xrd, Sign. So,
indeed.
Slaggy, I think you probably want to talk about this next one.
Yes, we have word from the Pokemon Company that a live concert series titled Pokemon Symphonic Evolutions will be kicking off. As of right now, we only have two dates for this engagement. The first one is the opening night on August 15th in Washington, D.C., and then also in September on the 19th in Philadelphia. The Washington, D.C. premiere of Pokemon Symphonic Evolutions happens to coincide with that weekend's Pokemon 2014 World Championship.
Oh, exciting. For those of you who have been gaming for some amount of time now, I'm sure you remember Looking Glass Studios, responsible, you know, for PC games like System Shock 2 and Thief. Well, Paul Neurath, who was one of the co-founders of Looking Glass Studios, has opened a new studio based out of Boston called Other Side Entertainment. And their first game has been announced to be Underworld Ascension.
Oh.
Which is a sequel of sorts to Ultima Underworld.
Interesting. Witcher Battle Arena, which is a Witcher mobile MOBA, is going to be coming to tablets later this year.
A Witcher mobile MOBA.
Yes. It was developed by Fuero Games and designed by CD Projekt Red. It's a fast-paced 3v3 arena combat game. It will take less than 10 minutes per match.
Excellent.
One developer said a match had to fit within acceptable toilet time. Don't even say anything about acceptable toilet time.
We also have word here that Cliff Bleszinski, also known as Cliffy B, a former Epic Games design director, has announced that after having taken a sabbatical for the last year or two, he will be returning, or I should say, has returned to the video game industry last week. He will apparently be revealing details on his new project sometime in the next few days. And, you know, I guess we here at GameBuy really look forward to it. Before he got all, you know, focused on, you know, sort of the whole chainsaw gun Gears of War thing, Cliffy B actually had a lot to say and do that was really constructive in the industry. So it'll be interesting to see if he gets back to that, or if he's just gonna keep on being, like, dude bro epitome Doritos king.
Dude huge.
Dude huge.
So, in an interesting little tidbit of news, the Western version of the Vita game Freedom Wars will only include Japanese audio with subtitles available in multiple languages. A physical edition of this sci-fi game is definitely planned for North America, but just not with, you know, dubs. Not a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, here in a surprise announcement, we have word from Sega that they are going to be releasing Hatsune Miku Project Mirai in the U.S. This game, or I should say in North America and other English-speaking territories. This release for the 3DS is going to be based on Hatsune Miku Project Mirai 2, but it's going to be called Hatsune Miku Project Mirai Remix, and have added features from the Japanese release of Mirai 2, on which it's based.
Mm.
So that's very exciting. We also here have news that the reveal, the worldwide exclusive reveal, of the new Doom game is going to occur for in-person attendees at QuakeCon this July 17th.
Interesting. So in some sad news and surprising news, the executive producer of Blizzard, Rob Pardo, has announced that he is leaving the company. He has not announced his next steps. He's just said, you know, he wants to spend some time with his family to consider where the next step in his career is. And, you know, he says that he enjoyed working with the titles such as Diablo 3, World of Warcraft, and Heroes of the Storm, and will continue to update about his next moves via Twitter. A lot of people are saying, oh, Blizzard's falling apart, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Greg Street, a.k.a. Grosscrawler, who, for those who know, the WoW community left to go to Riot Games, and, well, I mean, I guess some people think that WoW is falling apart, but the game's still doing fine.
So, I have to say, you know, I really don't think this has anything to do with Blizzard being in ruins. I don't think it has anything to do with the longevity of WoW.
Or Activision, blah, 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 blah.
You know, Rob Pardo is notable for having designed StarCraft. He designed Warcraft 3. He designed the earliest iterations of World of Warcraft. He designed Diablo 2. You know, this guy, he makes games. He makes these big, super complex, stat-based strategy, like super intense hardcore games. And I feel like this is probably a matter of him wanting to do something more than what Blizzard's business plan for the next 5 years looks like.
Yeah, I agree.
You look at what Blizzard has going on, and it's pretty much all, you know, Hearthstone, Heroes of the Storm, which is still in beta.
You know, they had to scrap the original plans for that, what was that called?
So you're talking about Titan. And I was going to get there. You cut me off for something you couldn't even remember the name of.
Rude.
Yeah, you are. You cut me off, man. but, you know, again, but that does tie into what I'm saying. You know, they're doing support on Hearthstone. They're trying to get Heroes of the Storm finished. They're doing third installment of StarCraft 3. StarCraft 2, I'm sorry.
They just did Diablo 3's expansion.
Well, they just did an expansion for Diablo 3, but the original indication was that there was gonna be two expansions to that game.
Right.
You know, obviously, they're working overtime on a WoW expansion right now that's obviously running behind schedule. And obviously, there will have to be another WoW expansion behind that. So, you know, Blizzard just looks booked for the next 3 or 4 years. Like, what release windows do they possibly have for new titles?
That's true.
And you look at Rob Pardo's chops, and this is a guy who makes strategy games. He makes basically the kinds of games that Blizzard isn't really making right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'll be honest, I don't think this speaks to anything other than Rob Pardo, to me, is either about to pop up at another studio with a game announcement, like, oh yeah, we're gonna do this strategy game, I'm gonna design the systems, or in 6 months, I think we're gonna see this guy spearheading a Kickstarter to make a game.
Interesting.
I don't see him leaving the industry, and I don't see this as reflective on Blizzard, other than Blizzard just doesn't have the resources to do something new. And a lot of times you see these guys, you know, he was with Blizzard for what, 10 plus years?
17 years.
17 years. Yeah, that speaks to me that, you know, he wants to move on to something new, not anything else. Because, you know, after 17 years, he really probably didn't have to work too hard on the scale of things.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sorry, even with WoW subscriptions maybe dwindling again, I mean, that's natural in every expansion. You know, there's a new WoW expansion coming out, like you said. There's another StarCraft expansion on the way, likely a Diablo expansion. Heroes of the Storm, Hearthstone, like, Blizzard's not crumbling and into ruins.
Yeah, you get really focused on that defensive Blizzard thing, and I agree with you. Blizzard is fine. Like, anyone who rants like a fanboy on forums clearly isn't paying attention to what actual numbers look like.
Some people just want to watch the Blizz burn.
That's probably true. Speaking of Hearthstone, there was a minor controversy earlier this week when it appeared that the International Esports Federation planned to bar women from its upcoming series of Hearthstone qualifier tournaments in Finland, under the belief that gender segregation would add legitimacy to the idea of video games as a proper sport. You know, following a flurry of online controversy, Blizzard basically stepped in and was like, women are gonna be allowed to compete, dog.
Or you ain't gonna get to play this game.
Exactly so. So, this has been undone, and women can compete at Hearthstone.
Yeah. And in our last news, can I take this one?
Of course you can.
Pokemon Center online store opens on August 6th. So, Pokemon Center online shop, very similar to the Pokemon Centers around the world. So, you know, the Pokemon Centers are still alive and well in Japan and possibly elsewhere. But you will now be able to purchase Pokemon goods online. If you're just super excited and can't wait until August 5th, you can get a $17.50 Mewtwo tumbler. That's like a drinking cup, not a web vlog. An adorable $13 Pika plush, and an adorable $24 pack of keyrings with Eevee and its evolutions.
And, you know, that's great because some of this stuff, if you go online, you can find imported copies of, on eBay or what have you, for exorbitant prices. That set of Eevee keyrings I saw on eBay recently for like $75.
Yeah.
So this is definitely better.
And, I mean, it is worth noting that this does not include Sylveon. But, oh well.
Bitch, that ain't worth noting. Nobody likes Sylveon but you.
I bet you're about to get a legion of Sylveon fanboys angrily tweeting at you.
If that means they listen to the show, I'll take it. I don't care.
BRB registering the Twitter handle Angry Sylveon Fanboy to troll Captain Spike.
All right, well, that's about going to do it for our news, but we do have one real quick.
That thunder scares me.
So, in sad news, it looks like the developer, Airtight Games, behind the recent release, Murdered Soul Suspect, has closed its doors. You're probably familiar with Airtight Games for some of their other games, such as Capcom's Dark Void, the Ouya roguelike Soulfjord, and Quantum Conundrum, which was a first-person puzzler directed by Kim Swift.
Yeah, I think, like, we've talked about all of these games on Game Buoy.
Yes, we sure have. Obviously there's not a whole lot more to say. They've shut down. Their employees have been laid off. You know, this really sucks. I hope that all of you folks, land on your feet, get jobs real quick. And for what it's worth, I've heard good things about Murdered Soul Suspect. It's apparently kind of bad as a game, but it's apparently a great as like a visual novel.
Oh, that's good.
So, we're pouring one out for you guys, Airtight. And with that, I guess, it's time for us to have a little talk here. So, let's get started.
What did I do now?
I meant for our discussion. So, yeah, we are going to be talking here about the somewhat recent trend of using throwback game and visual design elements in sort of a more modern setting.
That we are.
this has been sort of a hot button issue since the release of Shovel Knight. It was a hot button issue back when Mega Man 9 and 10 came out. There's a very vocal opposition to sort of these classically retro-designed games, I find. And so we just kind of wanted to talk a little bit about this because, it's popping up more and more, especially, but not limited to, in the indie scene. So we here at GameBuoy.org, sort of wanted to take a look at sort of the three sort of main approaches that we see in this sort of retro throwback game design. That is, of course, games that are sort of designed to look and play like old games. And we have like four titles that we want to talk about there. Then we're going to talk about games that just use retro aesthetics, sort of more modern game design, but with an intentionally old-school look. And then we want to take a look at games that just take, like, sort of the base of, like, old-school and just run with it in all new and crazy directions.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk probably only about 10 games here. And this isn't because that's all that we want to talk about. It isn't because, there's not other good retro games out there. Because there are literally hundreds. But, there's just no way we could talk about everything. So we wanted to talk about what we see as sort of the three pillars of this kind of game design. And we picked a handful of games to sort of cover within that sphere that are most notable. So, definitely, we are always interested in hearing from you guys. If, like, we've missed titles that you really wish we would have talked about, tweet at us over at GameBuoy.org, D-O-T-O-R-G.
At GameBuoy.org, D-O-T-O-R-G.
Hashtag it with GameBuoy Extra.
Hashtag GameBuoy Extra.
If it necessitates it, we'll definitely revisit this topic or do a micro on the game of your choice or what have you.
Oh, it might be a Kickstarter tier.
Ooh.
For $1,000, you can choose a topic of your choice, so we can eat Taco Bell.
Yeah, this is Game Buoy. Like, if we did a Kickstarter, it would be for, like, $25 so I could buy a fan for the studio.
Yeah.
And the rewards would be, like, for $5, we'll take pictures and write you an intentionally bad fan fiction.
Careful now.
All right, in any event, let's get to this first part of the discussion, which I call throwback caps, and talk about some of these games that are designed to look and play like old-school games. And I think this discussion really starts with the 2007 title Game Center CX Arena no Chosenjo. And this was, of course, released in North America in 2009 as Retro Game Challenge.
Thanks, XSEED. Now, we have talked about Game Center CX quite a bit on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org?
Yes, we have. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of this first game, Retro Game Challenge. I love the dressing of it. I love the way that it's presented. You know, we've talked about this here on the show, but this game is sort of based on the Game Center CX TV series, where Shinya Arino sort of, you know, plays games and talks about them, even though he's awful at them. And,
right.
You know, sort of has a lot of really interesting things to say about classic video games. It's a great show. One season of it was brought over with English subtitles by Kotaku, of all places.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So that was a pretty big deal. You can find episodes online. Those official subs you can find even on Amazon now. You can buy a DVD set. And there are fan sub groups that fan sub this every time there are new episodes. So...
Did you hear that Gact's doing a game a day because of Nestle?
Yes, yes.
He played Mega Man 2 and had attitude about it.
Yeah, well, he died so fast. I love Gact. In any event, though, what the Retro Game Challenge game did was it sort of had, like, this entire overworld, almost, that was, like, an RPG where you're playing as, like, a 7-year-old boy who just got his first Famicom. But the real gameplay is just in playing these sort of mock-up Famicom games. And so, you know, all of the games were made specifically for Game Center CX / Retro Game Challenge. But they're presented as if they were real games made in that era. They all had, like, fictional release dates and companies that made them. And they're all of them are throwbacks to, like, very popular styles of games. You had Cosmic Gate, there was Robot Ninja Haggleman, Rally King, Star Prince, Rally King XP, or SP, Robot Ninja Haggleman 2, Gaudia Quest, and Robot Ninja Haggleman 3. And probably the most notable games were the Haggleman games, which the first one starts as almost like an old Tecmo-style, like, Mighty Bomb Jack ripoff. But then it becomes almost like a cross between Mega Man and Ninja Gaiden.
Mm.
And they play it like absolutely like old games. This game, Gaudia Quest, is straight up a Dragon Quest style 8-bit RPG.
Like, is it a full length RPG?
It's not full length in the terms of being like 20 hours, but it is a multi-hour RPG.
Wow.
With encounters and gear. It's like a full-fledged game.
Wow. The thing that I think is interesting about the original Game Center CX Retro Game Challenge, and I'm sure that this has continued on to the sequels, but that Arino-san wanted these games to include, like, the special sorts of, like, continue tricks or bonus characters in the games that he actually was playing on Game Center CX. And I think that's cute that, like, you know, it includes these little secrets, and, I mean, you know, we think about retro games and all the, like, Konami code and all that sort of thing. And so I think it's really cute that, you know, he was very, like, mindful about drawing from his experiences on the show.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And this was...
Okay, that's our only one. Okay, we did that, like, 4 times last week. That is the one. No more absolutelys.
Okay.
Girl. So, you know, there were also, like, racing game, classic-style NES-style racing games, you know, overhead 2D auto-scrolling shmups.
Oh, yeah.
And they were, again, you know, they were designed with, like, the limitations of the NES in mind, and they were really made to play just like those games.
Now, I don't remember well enough, did these even have screen flicker?
Yes.
Ah, how cute.
So, it was, they were very authentic. They really, it felt like you were playing 8-bit games.
Like, oh, these were just lost gems from Japan that we never saw.
Yeah, it really felt that way. It was actually almost, it was so successful and accurate in that respect that it was almost a little confusing. Like, playing that game made me feel like, it's impossible. How can these games have been made for this? Like, they feel just like old NES games.
Mm.
So, that, to me, is sort of where this conversation starts, you
know?
Yeah,
it's a bummer that it didn't perform so well over here, because we have not seen the sequels. Although, I guess the sequels have been a little bit more lackluster.
Well, Retro Game Challenge 2, as it would have been called if it came out here, Game Center CX to, you know, it was actually really well regarded. It also had analog Super NES games, Game Boy games, Game Boy Color games, and even Famicom Disk System games.
Wow.
And, you know, it also had, like, variants on the games from the first game. that were supposed to sort of teach you how to play old-style games.
Oh, wow.
So it was, you know, really cool package. It has gotten a fan translation. If you have any hardware for playing DS ROMs, I would highly recommend that you buy a copy of Game Center CX2 and then, you know, patch it or what have you. Because it's a really incredible gameplay experience, but unfortunately, the original game, Retro Game Challenge, it sold really well in its first shipment. You know, unfortunately, it had a real issue performing after that first wave of sales. And there's been a lot of speculation that it might have to do with that window of time where it released, where DS piracy just blew up.
Oh, yeah.
So that's really unfortunate, and it really sucks that we didn't get this game. You know, we used to talk a lot about Game Center CX3. Unfortunately, it released in Japan, and I don't know a single person who liked that game. So at some point, you know, the 3DS situation with imports is going to have to come to a head somehow, and I'm going to play that game at some point, but
yeah,
I'm not in any real hurry. Anyway, you know, I wanted to sort of lay the groundwork with that so that I could move on to the first real talking point that I think we have a lot to say
about. Yeah, that's Mighty Number 9, right? Oops.
Yeah, well, you know, we're talking here about Rockman 9, Yabo no Fukatsu. That is, of course, Mega Man 9, the revival of Ambition. Or, you know, just Mega Man 9 as it was released in North America.
Yeah.
This game was produced by Keiji Inafune-san and Hironobu Takeshita. And, you know, they basically took a look at the Mega Man franchise and sort of were trying to plot out where it went wrong in terms of, you know, games not performing well, you know, games not being well received, and they basically traced it back to Mega Man 2. So they decided to go back to Mega Man 2 and almost make like an alternate branch of history, to replace almost like the root of Mega Man 3 and what have you. So this means, you know, we went back and we lost the charge shot, we lost the slide.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the game was really well received. And something that's interesting is that Inafune-san had actually been talking about making a quote-unquote throwback title as early as 2004.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's really like, Inafune-san saw, like, Virtual Console, mm-hmm. for example, coming together. He saw that there was a real thirst for this kind of old school 2D content, and he thought, you know, hey, I think there's a market for 2D, like, classic games. And so he sought to sort of rehabilitate Mega Man and slot Mega Man as sort of this return to form for 2D gaming.
Interesting.
There was, during the development of this title, sort of some discussion that maybe they would allow, like, multiple, like, sprite sets so that you could play, like, NES-style Mega Man, or, like, Mega Man 8-style Mega Man.
Oh, huh.
But, you know, ultimately just going with 8-bit was sort of what was decided on. And, you know, Capcom themselves were actually very supportive, supposedly, at the time of Inafune reviving Mega Man. But I guess you have to look at, mm-hmm. you know, Inafune hadn't really fallen from grace there yet. But they wanted him to do, like, state-of-the-art 3D graphics and stuff. Like, they wanted it to be straight-up, like, a 3D game. But Inafune was, you know, the one that was looking at all of these different market influences, sort of the support of retro games, this idea that he had been sitting on since 2004. And so he really stuck to his guns and, you know, wanted to take Mega Man back to Mega Man 2 era. And so, you know, that's what made it to market, and it was successful. You may recall, a lot of our listeners probably were gaming when this game came out, unlike a lot of stuff we talk about. And, you know, you may recall, it made a big splash. A lot of people were very happy with it.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to look at the whole package with Mega Man 9, the promotional artwork, like, straight-up throwback. You have a poster of that, don't you? Or is it for 10 that your poster is?
So it's for 10, but I've taken it down.
Oh. But, you know, the artwork for this was done by IM8-Bit. And looks just like, you know, the classic Mega Man box art, you know, it's like just acknowledging the entire history of it. And I remember they had wanted to put it on NES cartridges, but, you know, just because it was actually too big of a game to fit on an NES cartridge, they had to scrap that idea.
And, you know, they did actually, in this new engine that they made for this style of graphic, they did implement a system where having enough characters on one line would cause sprite flickering.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. You know, they basically made a modern game engine to emulate 8-bit game engine. The game was also notable, of course, for having the first female robot master, Splash Woman. But funny enough, you know, Inafune-san only designed Plug Man and Splash Woman and allowed the artists over at Integrates to design the other six robot masters.
Oh.
And he had used Plug Man to sort of show them and to really teach this younger staff, like, this is how we used to design characters. Like, this is the style to design the next set of characters.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just think that's really interesting. You had, you know, Ippo Yamada come on board to do the music for this. And, you know, so many of these game, of the songs in this game really do call back to classic Mega Man tracks while still sounding like cool new shit. So, you know, the game was really well received and, you know, it did really well. Unfortunately, Mega Man 10 was done, you know, a year or two later, and it failed to sort of make as big of an impact. You know, funny enough, a lot of naysayers felt like the retro throwback style was only good for the revival and that the market wouldn't support sort of these older style games.
Mm.
Of course, now we have the benefit of hindsight. We know that that's not true. But, you know, it's sort of interesting to think that Mega Man 10 did not perform as well as Mega Man 9 for whatever reason.
Do you think it holds up to Mega Man 9, though?
Yeah, I think Mega Man 10 is great. I think it's probably harder than Mega Man 9.
It's probably better than a lot of the Mega Man that came after 2, huh?
Well, I'd certainly rank them both over Mega Man 5 or 6. So, you know, or, you know, most certainly 7 and 8.
Well, 7 is the one that sucks big dinosaur balls, right?
You could make that argument about a lot of the later Mega Man games.
I mean, in the song.
What song?
You know, the Brentel Floss song.
Not off the top of my head.
Gotta run now.
Anyway, the expiration of the retro throwback hypothesis has, of course, been, you know, denounced many times. It's been proven incorrect. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit real quick about why we're talking about this game this week. That is, of course, the release last month of Shovel Knight.
Shovel Knight.
Now, you know, Shovel Knight is sort of a hot topic, and we've talked about it here on the show as recently as last week. So I don't want to talk too much about it. But, you know, Shovel Knight is very clearly designed in the vein of the classics of the 8-bit era. It does play like a fusion of several of those classic games. And, you know, I really think that the success of Shovel Knight, you know, it's all anyone's been talking about is Shovel Knight, Shovel Knight, Shovel Knight. And, you know, while we don't have any kinds of sales figures yet, and we really won't until Yacht Club Games talks about it, which, you know, who knows if that'll ever happen, because this isn't, you know, a boxed product that we're going to see the NPD talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But by all indication, you know, it's reviewing incredibly well. Everybody's talking about it. It clearly has a huge footprint in, like, the mind space on, like, Twitter. Like, people are talking about this game. So it seems clear to me that it will have done well. And to me, it's funny because in a lot of ways, I feel like Shovel Knight is the most classic, the most respectful to the old classics of any of the games we're going to talk about today. Even Mega Man 9, to some degree, it felt like a little bit of, you know, Inafune-san was just trying to go back to what worked last and go from there. He wasn't trying to make, like, new cool ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Shovel Knight took sort of 8-bit game design and art design and really broke new ground with it, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's sort of interesting to think, you know, just that we sort of have this hypothesis that, you know, Mega Man 10 didn't do well because people were burnt out on retro throwback. But no, I don't think that that's true at all. I just think for whatever reason, Capcom missed the mark with Mega Man 10.
Yeah.
Slaggy, do you have anything to say about Shovel Knight from a design perspective?
I mean, you know, we kind of alluded to it last week during our What's Up segment, but I really like that, you know, a lot of people will compare that death system to Dark Souls. And I mean, I think that's like a really, that's something that you wouldn't have probably seen back in the day. But, you know, it controls really well. And I think, you know, we're going to talk about different types of retro aesthetics, but I mean, this looks like an NES game. It's not just like, oh, you know, it's a limited color palette. Like, it looks like a long-lost NES game. It's just that, you know, the design elements, you know, clearly take cues from a bunch of other games, and, you know, wouldn't have been possible. I don't think this game would have been possible to have been made back in the day because, you know, it drew influence from so many different games.
I think that's probably really fair to say, yeah. And, you know, the last one I want to talk here about, you know, fairly faithful games to the older styles. And while, you know, you mentioned in Shovel Knight's case, it did borrow some cool design ideas from more modern game schools of thought on game design, it's still at its core on a very fundamental level keeping with sort of those older style of games. In fact, while I found the game to be ridiculously easy, I will say I think that for most people it's fairly hard, it's fairly tricky. I've seen a lot of people complaining about the difficulty recently, but I feel like that difficulty was allowed by the game design. It's almost like they took the need to have quote-unquote Nintendo hard game design and level design and sort of justified it by including this more modern take on death and respawning.
I mean, I don't think it's too hard. I think the difficulty level is appropriate for, you know, being in the style of a game of that era.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, I want to talk here, the last game in this set of games, I want to talk about Cave Story.
Oh, yeah, Dokutsu Monogatari.
You know, Cave Story, of course, has a storied history at this point. It has gotten...
A cave storied history?
Oh, girl. It has gotten ports. The original released on Windows back on December 20th, 2004, and it got ports for Wii, Nintendo DSi, Nintendo 3DS, OS X, and Linux.
Now, the 3DS version was a straight-up 3D remake.
It actually had... It's available in two different forms on that platform.
Oh, really?
There's Cave Story 3D, and there's just a Cave Story Plus, which is a port of Cave Story Plus that is just available as an eShop download.
Oh, really? So not just the straight-up DSiWare. That's interesting.
Yeah, the DSiWare is just a port of core Cave Story that was okay. On the Wii.
Oh, thank you for clarifying that.
So we have, you know, this game, and I don't know if you've ever played it, but it's like a Metroidvania-style game, more Metroid than Vania.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, sort of, you know, a story about saving some rabbit-puppy hybrids, and you...
They're really cute.
Yeah. And the game is largely focused on, like, various kinds of guns that have different effects, and sort of finding, you know, like, health tanks in areas, and, you know, there's some really cool boss fights and puzzle solving. But to me, this game is important, this 2004 release, because this, for me, was the first time I saw an intentionally retro-designed game. You know, I talk about Game Center CX, and I think Game Center CX is important because it was the first time to me that I saw a big publisher dip their toe in that water. But Cave Story was the first time I saw someone intentionally design a sort of throwback aesthetic and throwback game design, not just for financial purposes, not like, oh, we're animating this with sprites because it's all we can afford. But this was clearly like a love letter to the classic Metroids and Metroidvanias.
Now, I know that Cave Story was done entirely by Daisuke Amaya-san. Now, has his other work been just by himself? Is Studio Pixel essentially just him?
So, you know, I don't really know the correct answer to that for you. It is my understanding that he does most of this stuff alone, but I couldn't say for sure that no one else works on these games.
Yeah. And I mean, you have to look at Cave Story, like you said, coming out in 2004, so 10 years ago at this point. And I mean, in some ways, you know, being a lot less further removed than we are now from these classic games, but for this game
Cave Story itself is a classic now.
Right? I mean, I just think the fact that, you know, one person made this gem, like, it's just so impressive, because it's such a cute little game. It's really well done, and, you know, it's not just like some messy flash piece of shit.
And, you know, it's just really interesting to sort of look at this sort of intentional throwback design that he did. And again, you know, he broke a lot of ground on that regard. You know, he sort of very specifically cited that, you know, he had looked to Miyamoto-san's game design techniques and its ability to teach players how to overcome obstacles without doing an explicit tutorial.
Learning from the masters.
So, you know, it's, I think it's really interesting that we sort of see here that, you know, in the case of Shovel Knight, you know, obviously Yacht Club Games went and looked at all of the old Capcom platforming classics, the DuckTales, the Mega Mans, looked at, you know, Konami's Castlevania series, and sort of took what was best from those. For Mega Man 9, you know, Inafune-san and company took a look at the earlier Mega Mans. Obviously, you know, we're talking here, Pixel took a specific look at Nintendo game design. And obviously, most importantly, in the design of Game Center CX, Indies Zero, the studio that worked on it, you know, they very specifically modeled all of these older games on, or all of these games on specific older games.
And it's just really interesting when you, you know, you choose this aesthetic and then couple it with the design. Because, I mean, back in the NES days, you know, the aesthetics were limited by hardware. But, you know, I think by going back to these classics, like, you really can learn a lot about game design because of, you know, you're not, you know, that's what the game was. It, you know, wasn't like, ooh, flashy, quick time events, blow up, bro graphics. I mean, the game had to, the game had to stand out as a game. It couldn't just be like,
stand out above the crowd.
You know, it was probably, in a lot of ways, a very ludological time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's a fair thing to say. And, you know, I actually would definitely describe myself as primarily a ludologist, because I do care primarily about gameplay and game design. I care very little for narrative or what have you. I'm, in fact, really only even concerned with aesthetics so much in as far as it supports the game design.
Right, and that's interesting to carry on to our next topic in this discussion, which is the look at the retro aesthetics.
Exactly so. Thank you for catching that segue. And we want to talk here about a handful of games that use the retro aesthetic, but rather than hewing close to that game design, that old school game design that we were just talking about, and talking about how vital that adherence was to the success in the cases of those four games we just talked about, I want to talk about a couple of games that took the look, but went in whole new gameplay directions.
I kind of like to think of this, I mean, you know, I can't state the developer's intentions in every case, even, you know, I mean, maybe some of them did feel this way, but I always feel like it's kind of like a, fuck you, we don't need big flashy graphics, and we, like, you know, maybe we love this aesthetic, you know, or maybe, you know, it's just because of limited art assets available on the team, or whatever, but, you know, not hindered by technology. And, you know, that really helps to show the game design choices shine.
Absolutely, man. So, you know, the first game I want to talk about here, of course, is Yusha 30, or Half Minute Hero, as you might be more familiar with it. And we are talking more specifically about the PSP release, rather than the original PC Freeware version. But, you know, the original PC Freeware version, it is worth mentioning, also did use a retro aesthetic. But basically, you know, this game used this retro aesthetic, pixel graphics, looking like an old-school JRPG, but really twisted up the gameplay design. And, you know, so the main mode, the Hero 30 mode, or Yusha 30, is basically just playing a JRPG in 30-second increments. And so you basically have, like, 30 seconds to, you know, like, get through the leave the castle, get your assignment from the king, get equipped in the local town, run to the cavern, kill the boss in 30 seconds.
So frantic.
Yeah, well, and it is. And, you know, it's interesting because it used this design aesthetic almost as like a shortcut to communicate to you what you needed to do.
Mm.
You know, it really, and it's interesting to think about it that way, but it sort of leveraged the tutorial aspect on, like, yeah, this looks like Dragon Quest. So just imagine Dragon Quest you have to play in 30 seconds.
Which, I mean, when you think of JRPGs, we made the joke about, oh, you know, it wasn't 20 hours. Hey, it's 30 seconds.
Right? And, you know, there are some other cool modes in this game where there was, like, a real-time strategy minigame and a shoot-em-up minigame and an action minigame, and they're all based on sort of similar conceits. But again, there are conceits within this own trapping, so you're ultimately sort of taking a look at all of these various different ways in which the narratives all sort of come together. And, you know, it's just really interesting to me from a design standpoint that Marvelous Entertainment took this visual aesthetic, this visual design, and paired it with such a forward-thinking game design to sort of create an experience that is both simultaneously all new and interesting and frantic, while also being really sort of nostalgic.
Yeah, yeah.
Psychic, do you have anything to say about Half Minute Hero?
No, I think you've really said a lot about it. I mean, you know, a lot of people for years have been able to make RPG Maker games and such, but I think really what stood out here and what we're looking at here is, like, flipping that around and, like you said, using the aesthetic to communicate game intention, etc., and try something new. Not that I have anything against, like, people making their own RPG Maker games. I think that's rad as hell.
Yeah, I downloaded that recently. I was thinking about how funny it would be if I made a Hunty Bunch game.
Ah, well, we've been talking about a Game Buoy RPG, so...
Right. Anyway.
It's going to be mobile social.
Don't even, man.
Microtransactions.
All right, well, the next game I want to talk about, of course, is What Did I Do to Deserve This, My Lord?
I hope you're not talking about having me as a co-host.
Bitch, I am, though. You might be more familiar with this game by its newer name, its original name, which was Holy Invasion of Privacy, Bad Man. What Did I Do to Deserve This? Unfortunately, there was some legal issues involving that name and conflict with the Batman franchise.
Mm-hmm.
It was renamed What Did I Do to Deserve This, My Lord? And this is a really weird game. You know, it uses like a cool pixel style aesthetic. There is some interesting stuff done with, like, light tracing and light sourcing or what have you, but it's still overall, like, a really clean sprite aesthetic.
Yeah.
But, again, from a game design perspective, I don't think I ever played any game like this, you know, back in the day. You kind of have to, like, dig through, like, tunnels in order to kill monsters, and almost like a take on, like, Dig Dug meets JRPG meets real-time strategy meets God game.
Yeah.
it's, you know, and I'm having a hard time describing this game because it was such a weird and cool game. If you've had the good fortune to play this, it was a PSP release. Pretty sure it's still available on the PSN shop for Vita, if you have a Vita. And, you know, it's a really cool game that took, again, this retro aesthetic, and it didn't really do anything... It didn't really use the retro aesthetic in any way other than as aesthetic, as opposed to Half Minute Hero, which we were just discussing, which I felt really used the aesthetic to communicate expectation. In this game, it was just kind of a flourish, and that's why I wanted to discuss it. It's still a cool game, it has a great game design, but it's really just retro for the sake of, like, oh, that's the aesthetic we went with.
And I think it serves it well. I don't think that, you know, I think it really is part of the charm of that game.
I would be inclined to agree. The next one I want to talk about here is Retro City Rampage. This is, of course, a game done in the graphical style of an NES game with the gameplay of, like, a GTA clone.
Right.
And, you know, this was a big deal at time of its release. It came out for the Wii, Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, PlayStation Vita, Microsoft Windows, Nintendo 3DS.
So yeah, you can get it pretty much anywhere now.
Yes, you can, you can. And this game, interestingly, used the aesthetic almost from like a nostalgia level, and also as almost like a parody of games, as like games commentary. I'm sorry, it seemed like you have something to add?
No, I was just saying, you know, especially when a lot of people, and I'm not trying to judge, but, you know, a lot of more mainstream games media and gamers out there look to the GTA titles as being like hallmarks of console generations. You know, they eagerly look forward to the next installment, and, you know, they are generally, I mean, although I do have my issues with the GTA games, and we might have to talk about someday, but you know, like, a lot of people will hold these in high regard. But I do like the way that Retro City Rampage is kind of like, LOL, we're, you know, throwing that on its head.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's really cool. Something that's really cool about this aesthetic, and to really sort of punch home that nostalgic feel that it's going for is that it had, like, different screen filters that you could apply to add, like, scan lines to emulate, like, oh, this is what this game would look like on an Amiga.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's cute.
So, you know, again, from a gameplay perspective, this isn't necessarily my bag. But I really have a great deal of respect for the way it utilizes its retro aesthetic to sort of make a point on games commentary and sort of where we came from and where we're going.
Yeah, and you know, to be fair, he was a big fan of Grand Theft Auto 3, so it did come from a love, and you know, it wasn't meant to mock, but like really...
Well, this game even started as a remake of Grand Theft Auto 3 with 8-bit sprite graphics.
Oh yeah, Grand Theftendo.
Sprite graphics under the name Grand Theftendo. As you said. So, you know, he really built this up over years of his personal time. As an interesting aside, he has recently posted on his Facebook page that he hasn't yet made any money off of the original Wii release of this game because not enough people bought it on the Wii shop. So if you're interested in playing this game and you don't mind having it on Wii, he only needs to sell something like 500 more copies before he gets his payout.
Oh, poor guy.
Right? So, because that would suck, man, to upload this game and literally not get any money for it because it didn't sell enough. And then to fall short at just 500, needing 500 more sales, that sucks. So, you know, if you hear us talking about this and you're like, oh, I'd be interested in experiencing that, please consider the WiiWare version. You can play that on your Wii U through the Wii menu or whatever it's called.
And it's the only way to play it on Wii U at the moment, so.
Indeed. And you know, I don't have necessarily a lot to say about this game otherwise. It did have a really cool, like, prototype version that comes with the Wii version. It was actually, as far as I know, made its debut with the Wii version, but it has since been patched into the PC and PS360 versions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a prototype mode that it plays like an even further demade version of the game. So it's pretty interesting. And
ROM City Rampage.
Oh yeah, yeah, that is. But again, you know, I'm primarily just wanted to talk about this game using as retro aesthetic as nostalgia and to make its sort of narrative point. Like its narrative and game design is sort of, it's parody in nature and commentary on modern day game design. And the last game I want to talk about in this segment is Aben Hawkins and the 1000 Spikes. This was a 8-bit retro style game that was described by its creator as hardest, extremist, craziest platform action puzzle adventure game.
Ah!
Having spent many, many hours playing this game.
Many, many deaths, too.
And many, many deaths. I think that that's accurate. This game is noteworthy for having just recently got a sequel called 1001 Spikes. You know, which, you know, that's very cool. But I've spent primarily most of my time with the original, so that's the only one I can really speak to super authoritatively. Authoritatively. I can't do words. IDK. Anyway, you know, this game is a classic 2D game that really takes the tropes of classic game design and amps them up. So it takes this retro aesthetic and retro game design idea and, like, cranks it up. You know, when you hear people talk about Nintendo games, people often talk about a trope called Nintendo hard, which is that, oh, all of these old games are super hard because, you know, oh, they're going to have to last kids for, you know, 6 months until they get a new cartridge. They have to be super hard, so you have to learn how to play them.
And, oh, if you don't write down the password, you got to spend another couple hours getting to that point.
And
if
sort
there's
of,
even a password.
And so sort of the idea is that Aben Hawkins and the 1000 Spikes is actually that hard. The idea being that most of these old Nintendo games are not really that hard. We've just become used to games being much easier.
Press X.
Yeah, right? But
yeah!
1000 Spikes is that hard. There's all kinds of seemingly unfair deaths. It has, like, a very weird control scheme that initially isn't super user-friendly. But the real incredible thing about the game design, and you'll sort of notice this as you play it, is that, in fact, it really does call back to sort of old NES game design because you start to realize that the game is designed in such an organic way that after the first level or two that you've made it through, you'll notice that the same things happen based on certain level design elements. Like, oh, if there's a spot here of, like, a a brick with nothing under it, that brick's probably going to fall when I step on it, so I can't stand on it very long.
Mm.
And sure enough, once you do that and you jump off it, it's like, oh yeah, that is what I needed. And then you get to the next challenge. So it sort of used the retro game design from a aesthetic to sort of elevate its game design conceit to really communicate, like, no, this game is, it's going to kill you, it's going to murder you, and all that you really have to go by is this limited set of data that we're giving you to react to. So it's to me, it's interesting because it took this sort of retro idea and sort of what we were talking about with that last set, the games that were really true to 8-bit game design, but rather than being really true to 8-bit game design, it's true mm-hmm. to, like, the modern perception of 8-bit game design.
Indeed.
So I just find that to be a real, real interesting case because, again, in using this visual aesthetic and this idea of the gameplay being more demanding than those games actually were, I think it makes a really interesting point about the difficulty level of those actual games. Like, by the world at large, Mega Man 2 is considered, oh, such a hard game. But you talk to people who actually play those games, it's like, no, Mega Man 2 is actually pretty easy. Like, when I described Shovel Knight as easier than Mega Man 2, several of my Mega Man playing friends, like, were clutching their pearls, like, it's that easy?
Ah!
But, you know, to the world at large, they're harboring under this Nintendo hard illusion. They're like, oh my god, Mega Man 2 is so hard! But, like, no, games were not really that hard.
What was that Scooby-Doo voice you were doing?
That was making fun of how old white women talk.
Oh, is that your version of Mario and Sonic at the Olympic Games, going out for some pasta?
Yes, very much. I think that would be accurate to say.
Whoa. I'm going to go back and play Wii Tennis. Although my arthritis is acting up.
Okay, that's enough of this tangent. All right, so that's sort of that set of games I wanted to talk about. And, you know, again, we're really talking about these games as relates to sort of the use of aesthetic and the use of styling. And so I want to talk about this next set of games. We just have two here, although one of them is cheating a little because it is itself a subset of games. I want to talk about games that sort of utilize old-school themes or visuals, but sort of twist them into new and interesting sort of presentations. And, you know, in some cases that means that it takes old game designs and brings them forward in new ways. In one instance, it brings an all-new visual style to a very classic style of gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start this conversation off with the obvious talking point of this kind of game. I want to talk about the bit trip family of games.
Yes.
And I want to start that off specifically talking about Bit Trip Beat, which is itself sort of almost like a postmodern take on the classic video game Pong.
Yeah, you know, we've talked, Captain Spike and I have talked a lot in the years before Game Boy about the development of the Bit Trip series, and the Bit Trip series is almost in a way like alternate gaming history. Like, I mean, like you said, this is the Bit Trip Beat release is a lot like Pong. And then as we go through these games, you look at the, like, way that they eat, there's, like, new little elements added in. And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, well, you know, we had Bit Trip Core, which had, like rhythm elements. There was Bit Trip Void, which was, like, you know, this really actually, like, strange experimental kind of game.
Core was almost like a bit of a little shooter, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I think the game that is probably most well-known at this point was Bit Trip Runner.
Yes!
And, you know, Bit Trip Runner is sort of notable for having, you know, those incredible bonus sequences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the core game, it did use a lot of sprite, or not actual sprite art, but it used, you know, polygon art and minimalist art to sort of evoke
right.
retro feelings. And it had, you know, really cool chiptune music, including, like, credits and menu music by Anamanaguchi.
Yes.
But it had those really incredible bonus stages that were specifically themed off of, like, Atari graphics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, using almost, like, Atari-style audio. So what you really had here was this game, it used the sort of retro aesthetic in a way to sort of evoke, like, a nostalgic feeling, but also to sort of strip down the presentation in such a way that you could more easily read what was going on. And it's funny because, you know, we're not really going to talk about Runner 2 in this conversation, but One of the more common complaints about Runner 2 is that, you know, they put so much work into, like, the visuals and stuff, but in certain instances, the visuals were too complex, and it became more difficult to easily read what the level design was actually asking of you. So, you know, that's actually really interesting. And you have here, we also saw these guys do BitTrip Fate, which was a rhythm shooter, like a shmup. And again, all of these games that we're talking about use pixels and minimalistic visual design to sort of evoke retro feelings of nostalgia while doing things within the games that would never have been possible in these older designs. And the last game I want to talk about real quick in this little subset was BitTrip Flux, which was almost like a return to BitTrip Beat, except it had, like, multiplayer modes, and it was almost like an alternate take on Pong, like a future retro Pong.
Well, it's kind of like you've played the other BitTrip games, now play this one.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it really drew elements from all of the other BitTrip games.
I can see that. You know, for anyone who's interested, of course, the BitTrip series has released on Windows, OS X, Linux, iOS, PlayStation 3, PlayStation Vita, Wii, Wii U, Nintendo 3DS, Xbox 360. But the first one, BitTrip Beat, was a Wii game.
Yeah.
That was back in 2009. And, you know, it's really interesting the way that this game sort of took the retro style and just went crazy with it. You know, it's real evocative of the classics. You know, we didn't really talk too much about the sound design of BitTrip Beat and BitTrip Runner in particular, but, you know, we had mentioned the chiptunes angle. Like, these games may not exactly look like NES games or Atari games, but in a lot of ways they really do sound like them.
Well, yeah, I mean, BitTrip Beat is just like beep, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, 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 beep, boop, 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 boop.
So, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I did not expect you to do this weird little beepy thing, but
beep, beep, boop, beep, 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 beep.
And, you know, BitTrip, the BitTrip series, I think, is a really great primer for, you know, sort of to see what you can do within sort of the retro design aesthetic without hewing so closely to sort of classic game design, even though in a lot of ways, these games do leverage sort of what you already know about classic game design.
I think you describing them as postmodern is the perfect descriptor because, I mean, it's really like, oh, this is Pong, but it's got like these rhythm elements and you're playing it on a 2009 console.
Oh, all right. Thank you for that. Oh, well, then I guess that moves us on to the last game we really want to talk about here, which is another game that sort of takes retro design as its starting point and then just goes batshit crazy. This is, of course, 3D Dot Game Heroes,
yes.
Which, if you're not familiar, it sort of creates a 3D world from a sort of three-quarters overhead viewpoint, similar to the old 2D Zelda games. And this game in particular actually plays very similar to the first Zelda game. But it uses 3D voxels, sort of as independent, like 3D sprites almost, like individual sprites. And so you have just tons of particle effects going on manipulating individual voxels that look like individual pixels into like a really striking take on old school visual design.
A lot of people today might say, oh, it looks like Minecraft.
Well, they might, but it was many years before Minecraft.
It was.
The original released in Japan in 2009, came to North America in May of 2010, as well as Europe later that week. This was a PlayStation 3 game and has, to date, only been released on PlayStation 3.
Yeah.
And something interesting about this game, you know, it has a plot, and I'm normally not super interested in plot, but the actual plot of the game is that originally it was a 2D pixel world, but the king of the land felt that sprites were outdated, and so he decreed for the kingdom to make the switch to 3D.
Love it.
Yeah, and so this game, again, in a really interesting way, it really was a graphical showcase despite this weird style because very much the hook to this game is like, oh, it's like Zelda, only with this really incredible technology doing the visuals. And so in that way, it's maybe not as interesting as some of the other games we've talked about here today.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are also some really cool customization elements where you can use a tool in the game to, like, model your own sprites of, like, oh, this is the sword I'm wielding right now. I want it to look like a sock.
And can we just mention that Silicon Studio went on to develop Bravely Default?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Just saying.
If you have a PS3 and you're interested in games that play like Zelda, and you're interested in games that do sort of interesting, cute things visually, you actually really owe it to yourself to play this game. And it's really interesting because it uses this visual sort of as a throwback, almost to, like, justify the old-school style gameplay, but it doesn't necessarily, from a gameplay perspective, do anything super new and refreshing. It's just a really beautiful game with a great sense of humor about itself that, you know, plays well. But again, it's interesting from that perspective, and it's what I want to use to springboard into the next part of this discussion. It's interesting as a what if. You know, I feel like we don't see enough game designers and people doing game visuals and what have you, sort of take a look at, like, how can we do sort of throwback-influenced games that go in new directions visually? Because this game really does, it uses, again, 2D sprite art as a starting point, but then it goes off in this really strange direction using, you know, what was at the time very modern tech, within the PlayStation 3, to sort of achieve a visual that is really unique to itself. And mm-hmm. And to me, it's sort of interesting to look at, you know, sort of in the future, what kinds of games we'd like to see. For me, I feel like I would really like to see games in the future do an approach similar to this game. Ideally with more innovation in the gameplay space as well, but, you know, that's a discussion for a different time, I guess. So, Slightkick, unless you have anything else to say about 3D.GameHeroes, I want to get to that part of the discussion and wrap this up.
No, I mean, you absolutely did it justice.
So, Slightkick, I want to wrap this up. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, I know there were some games that probably could have been talked about here. We probably could have done a whole segment on, like, modern sequels. Maybe Mega Man 9 would have belonged in that discussion then. Of modern sequels that are from a gameplay design and or a visual design based on classic predecessors.
That's true. I mean, you have to look at the fact that Nintendo is doing better making Mario platformers, 2D platformers, than they are with their 3D platformers. So, I mean, I think that really says something. I think the success of the Virtual Console really says something. I think the success of, you know, the random arcade or retro game released on PSN or Xbox Live really says something. But like you said, it's almost a different sort of discussion because, I mean, these are just taking, like, you know, it's Mario old design ideas, but, you know, done in a new visual way. I mean, you could put Sonic 4 in there, whether or not you think it really was successful at doing that.
I actually like Sonic 4 a lot.
I know you did. Oh, no, I was just saying that, you know, it's really interesting to kind of look at, you know, even if we wouldn't consider something like New Super Mario Brothers franchise to be a retro game. I mean, it really does take its roots from the classic platformers. And, I mean, you kind of see, I mean, A Link Between Worlds could have been done with the Ocarina 3D engine or something, you know. There's no reason that they had to make it a sequel in the same perspective as A Link to the Past. You know, but I mean, I think there's definitely, it's interesting to really see that there is definitely, at this point, a thirst for retro in some ways of gaming. I'm not saying that it was never not there, but I mean, just in a larger scale. I mean, you always saw at the mall, there'd be like those Pac-Man plug-and-play little arcade things, you know. And there've always been like retro console emulation things. So, I mean, it's really interesting to tie back to what you said about Game Center CX and how it kind of wasn't the right time for it. Now we're really at a time where people are like, okay, yeah, like, and it's almost kind of like a cool thing, like, ooh, hey, we got retro graphics. And I think the only thing that I hope is that people don't think that they can rely purely on the retro charm of something without
stop
having...
Stop relying on that retro charm.
And I don't think we... I don't think we've really seen that yet too much. I mean, maybe there's a game or two out there, but I really think, you know, Nintendo, of all people, kind of clued into this. You look at, you know, like the new Kirby game, which is like a, takes elements, you know, from old Kirby games, but, you know, still does something new, so...
It has a super secret retro throwback secret. If you had played all the way through that game and done everything, you'd understand what I was talking about right now, and you'd be like, oh, shit, yeah, that does belong here.
Yeah.
But I guess probably most people never will, because it's even gated behind, like, the true arena competition and stuff, which sucks. But, I mean, it sucks to play. And that this content is locked behind there. But it you're right, I hadn't even thought about that. But now that you've mentioned it, it's like, actually, yeah, that game has a retro throwback segment that's really cool.
Mm.
But yeah, you know, and the next thing I want to say is, you know, we were talking a little bit about 3D Dot Game Heroes, which really had this really phenomenal visual gimmick that maybe wasn't quite up to the task of the gameplay of the game, which was a little bit, let's just say, tried and true. Is that, what, let me say this, what direction would you like to see retro throwback games go in the future?
I mean, I'm more inclined, I think there's always a place for a good tried and true, you know, classic JRPG, classic 2D platformer. As long as it's charming, cute, and fun, it doesn't necessarily need to be super innovative. As long as it's, you know, as long as it's a good experience.
Oh, right, you're a Zelda fan.
Oh, I don't mean it like that. I'm just saying that, like, if one of our Game Booey friends put out a classic JRPG, they made an RPG maker, it's like, oh, hey, you know, this is really good. It doesn't have to break new ground, but that said, I would prefer to see things more like, and I know this is kind of taking it from two different categories that we were talking about, like from the Shovel Knight, like, you know, I want to see that, like, faithful representation of the era with, you know, new gameplay elements, but also...
So something like Fez...
Something like Fez, but also...
Which had a really great classic visual until you got into, like, the 3D perspective shifting that definitely could never have been done back then.
Mm. But I also mean things like Half Minute Hero and Super Time Force that, you know, both kind of playing with time. You know, like, I think that's a really interesting thing that people are starting to explore and really, you know, like the working with time in a game, you know, that continuum.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I wouldn't really call... It's interesting, actually. It's almost a sidebar here, because there are a handful of indie scene games right now that do use, like, pixel, like, sprite-based art in an entirely new way that, to me, doesn't look retro at all. Like, stuff like Super Time Force,
I would argue
Grow
that...
Force, Below, but also by Capybara.
Right, I would argue that they evoke a certain nostalgia, though.
Maybe. I guess I don't feel that way about Super Time Force, because I get nostalgia from Super Time Force and Bro Force from the way that they play with 80s action movie tropes.
Okay.
But from a visual perspective, I feel like there's no console in the history of anything that could have done this before now.
Oh, I agree.
So it doesn't feel throwback that way, even though we think of pixels and sprites as retro throwback.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I was not saying that those feel like, oh, that looks like it's straight out of an NES, but it definitely does, for me, evoke that sort of, like, ooh, pixely, like, I like that, but...
I mean, and don't get me wrong, I love that pixely look. It's just, it's almost like a new style of pixel art, I
which
feel.
Is great, which I think is another really interesting direction that this subset of games could take, but I think really ultimately what I want to see is, you know, what Mario Maker is starting to introduce, and I know that Mario Maker also will let you make a new Super Mario Brothers game, but I mean, I really want to start seeing, you know, because this sort of retro aesthetic is not, you know, like, super taxing. You don't have to, like, do all the programming, blah, 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 whatever. I would really like to start seeing this as a tool for, you know, putting this into our hands. I mean, we've had RPG Maker available for years and years and years at this point. Mario Maker's coming. And I would really like to see, you know, retro throwback kind of be the medium through which game design becomes more accessible and that people really truly learn about game design and, you know, really kind of shift that whole perspective back towards, you know, the whole ludology versus the narratology debate, you know, that all the game theorists are like, blah, 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 and, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's got a good story, though. And, you know, I used to tease you for that, but I think I used to tease you for being like, ugh, game stories aren't important. But now that we've done Game Buoy and that I know you, and in the context of these retro games, really highlighting the design and that, you know, in some cases the aesthetic is just a specific choice, but really what all of these games have in common is some sort of, you know, focus on the design that really, you know, really stands out, so.
That's a great point. You know, I actually, I was gonna say some of those things you just said, but you sort of took the words right out of my mouth. So I think I can only sort of part with the thought that, again, you know, with this last batch of games that we were just mentioning as almost like a sidebar, that, you know, we are still seeing new styles pop up, new style, but new game design elements pop up within this sort of throwback genre, style, aesthetic. And so to me, it's really exciting, you know, to think that everyone talks, you know, about how all games are the same and there's not a lot of new content coming out anymore and everything's just sort of like, oh, this is just a remake of that. This is just riffing off those ideas. But to me, sort of the takeaway here is that a lot of these old design choices, both visually and from a gameplay perspective, there's still a lot of meat left on those bones untouched. There are still interesting and new and cool directions to take this stuff. Stuff like the, what was it, the Sword and Sorcery EP?
Oh, yeah.
Super Brothers, that is, which was a Capybara game, in fact, which did share a similar visual style to Super Time Force, Bro Force, Below, these kinds of
right.
games. And, you know, it's, again, my point, I guess, is that, you know, typically sprites, pixel, like, really big pixels are viewed as a retro, like, outdated, outmoded sort of technology, but clearly there are still new things you can do in that space. And that, to me, from as a gamer, as someone who really likes new and interesting gameplay experiences, I'm really excited about sort of the growth of this sort of throwback scene.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I think you really capped it up well.
All right, well, then let's end this and move on over to...
I said, hey, what's going on?
So I think the way to do this that would probably make the most sense is for me to start out talking about the game that I played that you didn't play. Then we can talk about the games we played together, and then I'll let you finish off with the games that you played that I didn't play.
Sounds good to me.
We probably should have worked that out off of air, shouldn't we?
Probably.
All right, so I'm going to start out talking about my resubscription to World of Warcraft. Now, I didn't let my subscription lapse because I was bored. I just kind of was busy in the month of June and kind of forgot to renew my subscription. So fortunately, I was able to get in during the tail end of the Midsummer Fire Festival, which, for those who don't play WoW, probably doesn't mean much. It's like a summer sort of 4th of July bonfire festival where you can get an experience buff. So I've been working on my Goblin Shaman over on the Winterhoof server. Her name is Sandwich. That's witch, like W-I-T-C-H, like don't fuck with a witch.
No one said you could touch.
And I'm kind of working on leveling her up, debating whether to do a level 90 boost once she gets to 60 to, you know, get to the current content. Gonna have to see. But, you know, just having fun. Like, you know, this game, I've been playing it at this point for, my God, 6 years or so. And so I always enjoy going back to it. I don't always stick with it, but, you know, I'm still finding ways to have fun with it. So, yay.
Excellent. That's great. I'm still a huge fan. I actually did play a little this week, but very little.
You've been dabbling with new characters, huh? And just playing classes and...
Yeah, I'm trying to... My new goal is to sort of see every zone, because there are zones even from Burning Crusade and Wrath of the Lich King. Like, there are zones where I've literally done no content.
You know, not to tell you how to play, but another interesting way to approach that could be to take, you know, maybe your one favorite character, your monk or whatever, and do archaeology, or also do the, you know, quest, like the quest achievements for, like, oh, every quest.
While I'm leveling, I do tend to do the quest achievements for whatever zone I'm in. But the unfortunate thing is that means I'm spending, you know, three or four, you know, 2 to 4 levels in each zone. So then by the time I wrap, it's like, okay, well, I need to go to the next tier. Like, I did this entire zone for my 44 to 50 phase. Now I need to go to the 50 zone. Like, I can't do the other 44 to 50 zone.
Right. So you tend to stick in a zone and stick with the entire, which I guess in Cataclysm, the way that they redid the zones, they really did a good job of making, like, the story, not to be an erotologist, but, you know, they really did a good job of making you be like, oh, you know, like, I need to hop over to Badlands now because this is starting to get boring over in Feralis or whatever, and keep you in the zone because you're like, oh, this Hillsbrad Foothills story where you're a quest giver and then you have to work with Derp. I love that, though! You know? So.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you're seeing content that you haven't before.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say, I appreciate your feedback, but there is no context in which I will ever fucking do archaeology. I hate the archaeology mechanic.
You don't want to be Professor Bone Puncher?
No, I would love to be Professor Bone Puncher. And I'd love to get some of those cool bind-on-account weapons, like the super badass-looking staves and shit.
Anyway, what were we playing together, Captain Spike?
Karaoke Revolution, American Idol, and Karaoke Revolution, and Karaoke Revolution Glee Season 3.
Okay, can I just say that Kararev Glee is a mess because...
Glee!
Because when you, like, what you do is you, it's like Karaoke Revolution. It's based more on the reboot, I think, because, let's talk about the reboot one first. So, let's talk about the let's talk about Karaoke Revolution American Idol first. Now, Karaoke Revolution American Idol was a Konami game, of course. And this one was notable because, is this one Encore that we were playing?
Yes.
Because this one actually has Paula in it. The first one did not have Paula Abdul in it. And of course, you know, now none of them are on the show anymore. But, we did a 3-round idol. And it was a close call, but, my character actually won the idol. So I'm the new American Idol. I'm really excited. I cried a little bit. But then for fun, we decided to try and do another round where we would flunk out at the audition level, and we both did.
And that was amazing when I did a...
Knock, knock, knock it out, heaven's hour.
And what song did I do? I did a...
Do you not remember your intentionally bad singing?
I remember my bad singing, but what song was it?
I think that was Walking on Sunshine, which was appropriate for you.
So anyways, you know, I think it's just as funny because you don't think of playing rhythm games for failing, but because Karaoke Revolution American Idol Encore has the element where, you know, there's a mode, you can do quick play, but there's a mode where, you know, you have to get to Hollywood and then you have to pass Hollywood around and you go on to the semifinals and then you're in the finals, you know, depending on how many rounds you do. And, you know, we intentionally failed out. And I thought Captain Spike was going to be like, no, this is a bad idea. But we were cackling and just having fun. Now, after that, we popped in Karaoke Revolution, the reboot for 360. And this was interesting because I had forgotten that they had kind of changed the scoring mechanism to, you know, originally they were more like what we think about in Rock Band. Because, you know, the Karaoke Revolution games were originally done by Harmonix, and, you know, they used that engine to implement that into the Rock Band series for the singing. But the scoring in the remake, the reboot, rather, of Karaoke Revolution was about, like, you know, getting awesome phrases so that you can build up your multiplier, and, you know, your multiplier gets up to, if you do a good enough job, like 43, 44, and then you get a bonus for, like, power phrases and stuff. So, you know, instead of getting scores that were, like, you know, in the 70,000, 80,000, you know, if you're doing pretty well, you're getting scores, like, over a million. So it's just kind of interesting in that respect. And Captain Spike created a really ugly character with the creative character.
Yeah. Latrice Poops.
And... It was kind of interesting the way that the progression of that game worked, because you have like a little like record that, you know, it builds outward, and there's little pieces of the record vinyl, and it's like, do a 3-song medley from country ballads and R&B. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting, kind of forced us to step out of our comfort zone, which is cute. Now, then we played Karaoke Revolution Glee Volume 3, which was, I think, based on the same engine as the remakes, because it had, like, the big multipliers and stuff. But there was also an element where if you do really well, that you try, if you're doing, like, great for 4 times in a row, it's kind of like a Star Power theme, but it's, I really didn't get, like, what it did besides give you, like, a bonus point boost or whatever. But you had to spell out WMHS, William McKinley High School, because that's where the Glee students go. And then when you got WMHS lit up, it would go, Glee! In the middle of your song, so you'd be like, with the taste of your lips, I'm on a ride. Glee! It was really distracting, and I'm sure there's a way to turn it down in the options. And it also was just a little embarrassing to play a Glee game.
Yeah, I tweeted an image of it, and immediately
it made Rob Roberts verp.
Ew. You nasty.
Oh, and then we also had played a bunch of Rock Band.
Yeah, but that's practically, like, expected at this point.
Yeah.
Let's see. So I played all of those, and I also played the iOS game, one that we talked about here on the show a few weeks ago. I have been playing Rhythm of Fighters. This is the King of Fighters rhythm game. And, you know, I wasn't expecting much. SNK Playmore, the way that they sort of leverage their franchises, it seems less like leveraging and more like exploit those, that fan base, you know, and their properties. It doesn't really feel like leveraging at all, but in this case, you know, it's basically Theater Rhythm. From a gameplay perspective, it's basically Theater Rhythm King of Fighters, and it's actually really cool. Like, it has a lot of the same mechanics as far as, like, some dots you have to just, like, press the screen on. Some of them you have to, like, swipe in a specific direction. Some you have to, like, press and hold and then release, or...
Huh.
Yeah, so it's actually really cool. Unlock systems seem really fair. There is microtransactions, but I've played it for probably 3 hours so far, and I haven't had a need to do any microtransaction stuff. There's no, like, shitty energy meter or whatever. It's all stuff that, to me, is okay. Like, if you want to play as Iori Agami, you better be ready to buy him. And I'm okay with that, because there are free options. Like, I've just been playing as Kyo, and that's been fine. So it's, you know, it's altogether actually a really solid rhythm game experience. I'm really happy I gave it a shot. It was like 99 cents. And I do absolutely feel like I got my 99 cents worth out of it.
That's great.
So yeah, that's, you know, I also started a second game of Shovel Knight. I'm New Game Plusing. And something that's really interesting about the New Game Plus in Shovel Knight is that all of, like, you have half as many checkpoints in every given level. All of the health refills, which I felt were, like, extremely plentiful in the core game, they're all now bombs, so they don't give you health, they damage you if you collect them. And all attacks in the game do twice as much damage as they did before.
Awesome.
So it is exactly the kind of gameplay I was expecting from Shovel Knight, and I am loving it. I'm happier than a pig in shit.
Ew.
In fact, it's funny, you know, I actually started it this morning, and I'm already nearly finished. I have, like, 2 more levels to do, like, just the Tower of Fate stuff already.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, I'm absolutely stoked. I'm probably gonna finish it as soon as you leave, so...
Is that a hint?
Maybe. Time to move on to, our social links.
Alright, our social links question of the week this week was... This week, we're talking about the trend of retro revivals. What game has done throwback style best, in your opinion? We got a tweet over on Twitter from KTaro E37 saying, Gunman Clive, hands down for me. It honors the past, but alters it into a mashup of different eras' visuals. Interesting.
That's a great point. And, you know, I didn't even think about that game, but it really is retro-ish. And just a cool game, and super cheap. Check it out on 3DS if you haven't already.
All right. Over on Facebook, we also had the Facebook bonus question. Do you prefer retro-style sequels or new titles paying homage to the classics, and why? Our first Facebook comment was from Jeremy over on the Koopa Club podcast, saying, even with Shovel Knight being as great as it is, I'm going to have to give it to Mega Man 9 for successfully recapturing what worked in the series while trimming the fat that had been packed on throughout the years. It really kickstarted the whole movement. I really can't decide whether I prefer of retro-style sequels or new titles. I like both because good game design never goes out of style. Oh yeah. Renee from the Killer Queens from Outer Space podcast said, with all the current titles available today, I preferred one that was released a few years back. Retro Game Challenge from XSEED or Game Center CX Arena no Chosenjao in Japan. Not only captured the retro style, but also the spirit as the game tossed a kid from the present back to the late 80s and incorporated fictional gaming magazines that you can look through for tips to play and beat the games, which included a variety of genres. I think ultimately if a game is well-designed, engages the player, and provides fun and entertainment, it doesn't matter what style presentation is used. Well said.
Yeah.
Ian from the Koopa Club podcast said, I don't have a favorite because I think they are still trying to nail it in some aspect or another. Shovel Knight for me was the first game I enjoyed that was a complete remix of the signifiers of the NES game design juggernauts. Him saying remix made me think of NES Remix, which is kind of an interesting other sort of retro throwback. Anyway, he continues by saying, I prefer new titles paying homage because I'm always looking for innovation and nothing stale. Last but certainly not least, we have Daniel T, who says, although I did just have an absolute blast with Shovel Knight, the retro-styled games I've enjoyed the most have been 3D Dot Game Heroes and Half Minute Hero. The first was a lovely and clever restyling of A Link to the Past, and the second satisfied my desire for absolutely manic gameplay. I tend to prefer new titles that use the retro art style or game mechanics in a new and interesting way. It always blows my mind to play something like VVVVVV that uses simplistic graphics combined with a sense of speed and intricacy that I don't tend to associate with the retro games I played. Yeah, you know, that's what we were talking about with, especially Half Minute Hero being super frantic. It is interesting to see,
juxtaposition.
That juxtaposition, exactly. Very well said. And so thank you to those of you who were responding to us in Facebook and Twitter. And speaking of Twitter, we fucking love Twitter, don't we, Crystal D? And so, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can, first of all, we'd like to say thank you to anyone who is a subscriber on iTunes. We love your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. We like your Facebook likes, and we fucking love Twitter. We like to tumble on Tumblr. You can plus one us on Google Plus. You can email us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Of course, everything is available, our entire episode archive with complete episode show notes with links over at gamebuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
You know, that's where the entire history of GameBuoy, for good or bad, is there. I think mostly good, but
I disagree.
Well,
I accuse my parents.
Well, some of those earlier episodes were a little bit rough, but here we are.
Move forward, girl.
Episode 58, and let's close it out. Episode 58 with some shout-outs.
As ever and always, I'd like to shout-out to Koopa Club. That's Koopa with a Q and Club with a K. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist. VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends. And the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. In addition, I'd be remiss not to mention Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. Speaking of Rob Roberts over at OLR, we also want to shout out to the off-season currently on hiatus, Reading is Fundamental. That's a show that Slagkick and I used to do along with Rob Roberts and Delvin over at VG Realness.
I wouldn't say used to do, just currently on hiatus.
Well, okay, that we do, but currently on hiatus, about RuPaul's Drag Race.
The seasonal show. That's sickening.
All right. And in non-gaming stuff, of course, I want to mention the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail, and X-Nation, rude.
Just kidding.
X-Nation over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants.
Fantastic. Take us to a game bar.
I want to take you to a game bar.
We've got Game Bar, the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. They are like the gay video game prairie home companion and part of the Hunty Bunch. We can't go an episode without thanking our pals over at the Nerdgasm Network, the wildest shock jock video game radio show that you'll ever come across. It's a bag of hot dicks. Over on the Voice of Geeks Network, we got two great shows that we like to tune into. That's VogNetwork.com. We've got Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO. And Horde House, the place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously. And I have to apologize in advance. I use Google Translate for this. Por último, pero ciertamente no menos importante, La Palanca Podcast. Podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. As ever and always, we want to honor and thank Zelda Reorchestrated for our wonderful theme music. You know, Zelda Reorchestrated was the project that aimed to present classic Zelda songs in a beautiful orchestrated format, and we're, as ever and always, pouring out a 40 for them. Must have spent a lot on these 40s at this point. 58 episodes of 40s. Well, I guess we haven't been pouring out 40s for the entire time, but for a while now, it's been a while.
All right, folks, thank you so much for spending this sunny Sunday afternoon with us. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we've enjoyed recording it for you.
I've enjoyed Slack recording it.
Do you have any final thoughts?
I was actually wondering if I could sign us out for the, after you do Keep Gaming, Keep Thinking, you know how you used to do Cowboy Bebop, can I do the...
I have one ready, though.
I have one ready, too.
All right, our lovely and beautiful listeners, thank you so much. We'll see you next time. Some of you, hopefully, we're going to see next week over at GamerX2.
Yes, please be sure to pop over on Saturday if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area to see people from the Hunty Bunch talking about podcasting.
All of that having been said, thank you so much. Until next time, keep gaming, keep thinking, and...
Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, 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 beep, 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 boop, boop, beep, 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 boop.
Aturantis, no nozzle.
Hey. We've heard from Kadokawa Games that their tactical We heard from Kadokawa Games that their tactical RPG nectar... I'm sorry.
Bando Nam. I did it again. I was specifically trying not to do it.
We keep doing that all the time. Dear Bandai Namco, please change your name to Bando Namkai. Well, yeah. It's because over here was Namco Bandai, and we're not used to saying it in the original order again.
Too hotly anticipated Bandai Namco. All right, so we have here release dates for...
Mega Man 2 is so hard! Mega Man 2 is so hard!
Like the super badass-looking staves and shit.
Staves?
That is not pronounced staves.
Is that staves? Staves?
Yeah.
Oh.
Like, think phonetically about how staff...
Staffs, staves. Yeah, you're right. And I'm a teacher. That's embarrassing.
Is it that E that was throwing you off?
Yeah.
Fair.
Staves.
You know, that's probably a valid pronunciation in, like, Europe or something. Probably.
Probably.
Also, anyway. Staving something off is a word, and so you might be taking it from there.
Okay, anyway.
So, you know, stave is a word. It's just...
Yeah.